Welcome to Bookish Podcast with Kath and Al, a podcast about books-ish. A quick disclaimer before we start, there may be some spoilers, so please save the episode for later if you don't want any. And also, please follow us on social at We Are Bookish Pod. We hope you enjoy. Hello.
Hi. Hey, girl.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. This is attempt number two at this episode.
Yeah, we won't talk about... I mean, you might have, if you are loyal to us, you'll know that we just didn't do an episode because we had some technical difficulties, and then it was my birthday, and then we just didn't have time, and we did try and record, and we did actually do like half an episode, and then we melted, our laptops melted, it was very hot, and we just couldn't cope. It kind of started out all right, like we kind of got into a swing of it, and then we just lost connection, and then it was just a nightmare, and it got to like 10 o'clock and we were both just melting because we had our windows shut, because like obviously you can hear the street outside, and we both have roof, like our rooms are in the roof, in the loft, we both have loft rooms, and we're just like, nah, this is not the one.
It was just like, yeah, we were getting hot. The laptops were getting hot. It was just a lot. It was a lot. And I think we tweeted about it from our socials. We were like, everything's fine, even though everything was burning around us. So, yeah. And then you had your birthday, Catherine. How was that?
Yeah, it was good. It was really nice. Had a good time. Got lots of book-related presents, which was always great. Yeah, it was really great. I saw some lovely people, including my lovely little Ellie. We did put a picture on our Instagram. That was for my birthday. finally, some pictures of us together, because we're sort of allowed to see each other now.
Yeah, it'll be more coming soon, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I'm a whole year older.
She's a whole year and a whole year wiser.
Yeah, exactly. Who knew? Who knew that's what happens? I felt so wise on my birthday. I was like, ugh, oh, got a whole another year's worth of knowledge now.
I'm going to impart knowledge on you guys. I think that's the thing that people should do, that they should impart their wisdoms from that year.
Yeah. I agree. I think my biggest bit of wisdom could be don't leave your wisdom teeth if they're infected.
Oh, yeah.
You should definitely go to the dentist. That would be my bit of wisdom. Definitely, definitely go to the dentist straight away. Don't just think that it's going to get better, because it
makes sure you
won't.
Floss, guys. Make sure you brush twice a day, you use your mouthwash, and go visit a dentist. Is the lessons we've learnt this year so far.
Yeah, we've both learnt that lesson this year. Well, to be fair, actually.
So I was going to say, it's not that we don't brush our teeth twice a day, by the way. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, not just to clarify. For me personally, I have terrible flossing habits, but also, like, just have problems with my wisdom teeth. And I always just... In my defense, my dentist is not in London, so like that's why I wasn't going to the dentist. I should definitely just get a dentist in London. I think that's the moral of this story.
I think wisdom teeth problem are common anyway. A lot of time it's impacted and they cause people a load of pain. So
yeah, but it just means I'm old and wise now. So
I've got the teeth in the back to prove it.
Exactly. But yes.
Well, we wanted to talk about this the last time we recorded, but we're still going to talk about it now because the campaign has been running for the month, which is the Spotify Only You. And you might have seen the ads on TV or on YouTube between the ads. I think there was one that was like, oh, 1,400 billion people listen to Lil Nas X, but only you could listen to him doing X, Y, and Z. So when they did release it, me and Kath did a little quiz on our Instagram. If you don't follow us on Instagram, go follow us. What's our Instagram, Kath?
At We Are Bookish Pod.
You heard her. You go follow us there. The Only You, I guess, is just like a rap. It's like Spotify Wrapped, but 6 months early, would you say? Is that right?
Yeah, it's like, so you can change your listening habits within the year so that your Spotify Wrapped is significantly cooler by the end of the year.
That is Kat's interpretation of what that exercise was.
So that then you have something shareable when you get to your Wrapped.
are you saying that you changed your listening habits, Kath? Are they going to be different from what we'll share at the end of the year?
I have stopped listening to Raxu now because I'm a bit embarrassed that came up.
I thought that was excellent.
I just obviously went through a phase earlier this year where Raxu was just the one.
Oh, well, for me. Like I said, we did a little test on Instagram because we wanted to see how much you've been paying attention to us in the last couple of episodes, sort of, I don't know, got a feel for our personalities. And also in the previous episode, we had sort of spoken about some of the music artists that we like.
Another embarrassing one for me is that I'm a bit of a Taylor Swift.
That came up on your thing as well, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but last year, my Spotify Wrapped, Taylor Swift was prominent. But I did go through a breakup, so I think it's totally allowed. Like, I think if you go through a breakup and you don't have Taylor Swift in your Wrapped, then
it'll never be in my Wrapped, ever.
Yeah, all right. I know your opinions on
she will never be in my Wrapped, ever. Was there anything else that was surprising to you, Ari, your Spotify Wrapped?
Well, I think the most surprising takeaway for me is that apparently I'm a Raxu fan. I'm not, guys, if you don't know what the hell I'm on about, they were on X Factor.
In the UK.
Yeah, in the UK. The latest. I don't think anyone else cool has come out of X Factor since Raxu. So, I don't even think I watched that series of the X Factor. I'm not sure how I've got, but they did their own songs on X Factor, so they were a bit of a hit at the time.
No, everyone loved them, even if they hadn't watched the series, because they'd heard of them and they were like, oh, so finally some good looking men.
Exactly.
Look at an ogle over that are actually talented. Exactly. Well, not that people aren't talented that go through it, because you know, Little Mix came through and they're great.
Exactly. Yeah, One Direction.
You know what was surprising for me? For mine, I apparently had played, I had played Billie Eilish after listening to Drowning Pool. And that to me just screams chaos. Absolute chaos. If you don't know who Drowning Pool are, like, so I used to be a big, like, WWE 90s era, like, fan. And that era is like, called the Attitude Era, so everything's just like pretty like kind of and then I played Billie Eilish right after it.
Thank you.
No, it screamed and not everyone else will hear it. So I thought that was really chaotic, but on the whole, from the quiz, people seem to get our music genres down pretty well. I'd say the majority of people got it.
Maybe we're just really predictable,
although there were some,
yeah,
where people were a little bit more unsure, so where it was like 58%, 60%. So I think for me, I had Books, Vocal House and Alternative Hip Hop. That was my genre combination, and I think there was a little bit more uncertainty there. And then with yours as well, because your genre combination was contemporary UK R&B and alternative British rock. And I think you could, that's when people weren't so sure. They were like,
why am I just listening to UK British artists as well? Can you tell me that, please? I'm sure that's not true. Like, I'm sure if you actually go through my Spotify, that's not a thing.
Oh,
no, but then we, yes, did a blend. So then we did a blend, and our, yes, blend was pretty,
so,
sick.
So I think we shared the blend on Twitter. Our Twitter is
@ We Are Bookish Pod.
There we go.
You see, you can tell we work in marketing because we made sure that our handle was the same across all channels. And it literally, I think when we set up our socials, we took like honestly an insane amount of time to find one that we could have on
meeting.
All of our channels. So
it was a whole,
yeah, it was for about 6 hours.
It was a whole meeting, but we did put it there. And actually, this quiz that went down really well on our Instagram. So there's a few more cards we didn't share that we might put back on as another quiz. And then at the end of that, we'll share our blend so you can listen to us and our music tastes in real time if you'd like. But we're not just talking about this for the sake of talking about it. Actually, it's not a huge tangent. These are markers of the things that make us just a small one.
But they are
the markers of things that make us, and who we are and our identity and how we perform our identity. And that's a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about today, because today we're talking about Bridget Bennett's The Vanishing Half. Which is on the Women's Prize shortlist.
Yeah. I think it's going to win. My spidey sense.
And when is that announced?
They've pushed back to the end. It was going to be 7th of July, but now I think it's in September for some reason.
To get the authors here? Because I saw some stuff where they were going to have live events with the authors.
There has been some live events, yeah.
But no, actually in-person stuff?
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know why it's been pushed back either, to be honest. But the long... So we obviously are invested in the long list and the short list, because who doesn't love the Women's Prize? And we actually... haven't made it through that many.
No.
But for my birthday, I did get a significant number of the books on the long list. So I got Unsettled Ground, Transcendent Kingdom, Exciting Times, and Because of You, which are all long listed. Some Unsettled Ground are shortlisted as well. So
and Transcendent and Kingdom.
Oh yeah, of course. How could I forget? So yeah.
You know what I did buy the other day? Actually, I don't think I told you. Because, you know, you were talking about Detransition Baby. Oh, we had a whole separate conversation offline because Kath was like, do I go and do the Waterstones? Do I buy stuff?
There was 10% off today. It is the 22nd of June and there was 10% off, but I resisted. Well, I still have till midnight, so ask me in a week's time whether I bought
anything. Should be there on Instagram like, I got the book. but I was going to say, I didn't reply to you properly, but I was going to say that I had picked up How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps a House the other day. Yeah, when I went to Paige's
Hackney. Oh, yeah.
So I picked that up. But yeah, I haven't, I'm having a bit of a
nice
reading block at the moment where I'm a bit overwhelmed by the amount of stuff I actually have to read. And so I'm getting through everything very slowly.
I literally have a stack so tall, and I went and bought another book at lunchtime today. What is actually wrong with me? I think I actually have a problem. Like, I was on the phone to my mum at the time. She was like, Catherine, you literally do not need to buy that book. And I was like, I know.
The cheek of it being £7 though, because I got that, wasn't it like £4.50? And like,
I know,
I got mine for fiver.
Yeah, I know. They've obviously hiked it up, but I was like, it's still cheap. Basically, it's Malibu Rising, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Taylor Jenkins Reid.
And we love her. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to do it. But anyway, so the Women's Prize. We think that The Vanishing Half might win, although that is the only book I've actually read on the shortlist. Yeah. So I'm a big Claire Fuller fan, so I'm very looking forward to Unsettled Ground as well, which I did. I got a book voucher and that's what I bought with it. So fingers crossed that it's really good. I'm sure it will be.
Have you?
I've actually met her. Yeah. She came to like a book club that I used to go to and got a little signed postcard with her bitter orange book on it. So yeah, there you go. I love meeting authors. I'm like, Why? Oh, you're so cool. I want to be you. I actually think if we met Britt Bennett, you would melt.
I don't think I've told the podcast. I'm terrible at meeting well-known people, so just don't bring me around them because I will embarrass you. I'll do one of two things. I'll either get really excited and scream in their face, or I'll say nothing at all and become a shell of a person. There's no in between. It's those two extremes.
Well, I tell you what we did do once, which was actually a bit rogue. 6 months ago, before we even launched the podcast, we both bought Claudia Winkleman's book because we have a story about us meeting her. And we were like, oh, we can tell the story and talk about her book. But I haven't even touched the book. I just have it.
I haven't touched it.
So maybe we'll do an episode on meeting which celebrities we've met and talk about her book and if it's any good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because although I said I got How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps a House, I actually am also excited to read Transcendent Kingdom by Jessie.
Oh yeah, me too.
And then the other books on the shortlist are No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, and is it Piranesi by Susanna Clarke?
I think so.
So they are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 books on the shortlist. We will be making our way through it, and I think we might chronicle our journeys through these on social. But also, there's some reading companion stuff that the Women's Prize have done that go along with each book, and they have like writing exercises and they have reading like conversation starters and stuff like that. So really recommend looking at all those bits if you're interested in finding out more or having a conversation yourself about books. So we're going to talk about The Vanishing Half.
Yes. So Ellie read this last year and she was like, you've got to read it. I was like, I will. And then I didn't. And then I read it this year and I was like, oh my God, why did I not read this sooner? It's so good. It was the book that kept on giving. I'm not gonna lie, I was really like really impressed. Really impressed. So it's like it's just got so much to it. There's so much substance to it. And also, I think we said this about Such a Fun Age, but Such a Fun Age is very different. But it talks about stuff that in an accessible way. I think that's like part of what makes it like it's not a hard book to read. Like it's a book that you can like read in like not necessarily in one sitting, but you know those books that you can just like race through and they're like page after page. It's like that, so it's really accessible to everyone. It's not like, you know, sometimes books that have like really important messages are sometimes a bit like they're really intricately written and really well written, but they're quite hard to like get through.
I get the feeling that with this one, and I was listening to like was it the Hollywood Reporter? It was like an actors roundtable, and it had like Reggae Jean Page and Chris Rock and John Boyega and Josh O'Connor, and I forget the other guy's name, but he's going to play Kang the Conqueror in Quantumania, in Ant-Man Quantumania, Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania in a few years' time. But it was great because one, it was a panel of like black men, black actors, and then Josh O'Connor, who plays like Prince Charles in The Crown. Hey, it's Ellie in editing. I just thought I'd drop in that the actor's name is Jonathan Majors. That's what I couldn't think of at the time we were recording. But also, fun little fact for you, Josh O'Connor, who plays Prince Charles in The Crown, is a Republican, but in the British sense, so he is anti-monarchy. So here's some useless trivia for you for a pub quiz. Anyway, back to the show. So it was like, yes, it's good to see things this way around. But also in that, Reggae was talking about how, like, it's what he loved about Bridgerton was that, you know, it was three-dimensional. So it's just like, yes, we're including, we're being more inclusive and stuff. And we're making, like, people of colour three-dimensional. So it's not like they're living in, I'm going to paraphrase now. What I'm trying to say is that this book does talk about colorism and racism, and that is, you know, some of the driving factors of this book. But Britt Bennett set out to write a story about family, and it was a family drama, and that is a lot of the vehicle of this book, I think, and just the race and the colorism and all that stuff sort of like is added to it, is an attribute to it, but it's really about the family unit and how they come together and fall apart, and that's what's so great about it. I think that's what makes it great, and it does it just so much better than Such a Fun Age. Such a Fun Age is fine, but this is just
that, just like the accessibility of it.
Because
agreed, this is a lot
it's
a lot better And so, but like, I don't want to be like, oh, it's loads bad, because such, I do also like Such a Fun Age, but it is just very, this is just next level kind of, this is like definitely a five star kind of book.
I think just because the vehicle of it is though that it's ingrained in the family and that family unit and what's happening with them, as opposed to we're looking at it from specifically a race or colorism point, even though that does inform a lot of this, that informs most all of the story really, but
it's just so skillfully woven,
it's so intricate, but handles lots of themes so delicately. It's fantastic. Did we have a synopsis of the book? I thought we did.
Do you have
for the book? I do. Oh god.
Do you want to read to me?
Read to me like you read to your girls. What? Paint me like how you paint yours. Whatever. I was making the Titanic reference. Oh, this is super long.
Go on. It's like a bedtime story.
The Vignay sisters will always be identical. But after growing up together in a small southern black community and running away at the age of 16, it's not just the shape of their daily lives that is different as adults, it's everything, including their racial identities. Many years later, one sister lives with her black daughter in the same southern town she once tried to escape. Across the country, the other secretly passes for white, and her white husband knows nothing of her past. Still, although separated by so many miles and just as many lives, the fates of the twins remain intertwined. What will happen when their own daughter's storylines intersect? I'm not going to do the last part, but that's basically what the book is about. And since the Vignay sisters are twins, and it was an exercise actually on the reading thing, I thought we'd actually have a look at myths, the cultural significance and myths of twins in literature, because that's fun, and I actually had a lot of fun. I don't know how we sort of get stuck on this point about twins on this podcast.
Yeah, it comes up a lot, guys. I'm not really sure. I think, you know, I think we maybe should address that. By the way, just a caveat, like, I literally am a twin as well.
There we go. So it's not like completely weird.
That's my twin bro. I'm sure he listens.
Yeah, Kathy's a twin, and why did we talk about? Oh, because we were talking about the one, wasn't we, and how that all worked, and there was a bit more to that. Twins. And I thought, if I can remember,
we couldn't quite get a head around that in the one. I think maybe we should add John Marr.
He did listen to the episode though, didn't he?
But he did, which is so cool. I love that.
Oh, imagine my God, Brit Bennett listens to this episode.
But
actually, literally, there's some truth, and I don't think I've written down anymore, but there is some truth to, so Hank Green did like a whole scientific look at twins and on YouTube, and there was something in it where you can have, I'm not going to remember it now, that there can be more similarity
for non-identical.
I'll have to look it up, and then we can add it or caveat it, or I'll insert it in editing exactly what that was. But I think we were trying to work out what similarities siblings could have, or twins, like in terms of matches if they're not identical. And in one case there's six cases of twins and how that works, and in this one case you can have more than 50%. But we can get back to that. Anyway, in literature, so actually this is quite hard to look up, but there's this YouTuber called Wonderfully Bookish, not to confuse us with us, who was doing a deep dive into twin representation, because she is a twin, or they are a twin. In this, they talk about this blog post that they'd read by Chapters and Charms that explores this a little bit more. So in the Chapters and Charms blog post, they characterize twin representation in books as interchangeable, direct opposite, and two halves of a whole. So what they mean by interchangeable, the first categorization, is that you can't tell them apart. So let's think Fred and George Weasley in Harry Potter. or like the Parent Trap, where they can't tell between the two twins. But in my head, I'm like, surely you could tell, right? Because
definitely can.
Like you'd hope your parents would know the difference between you two. There would be like small characterizations that would obviously would be a tell between the two. You would hope.
Yeah, definitely can. Yeah.
But so these set up then the tropes of being able to swap twins in and out of situations, and all that sort of hijinks and mischief that comes with those sorts of stories. The second is direct opposites. So that's where the twins have opposite personalities. So think any Mary Kay and Ashley straight to DVD film. Big fan, as you already know. So like where one is typically studious and the other one is like wild, or one is super girly and the other one's more of a tomboy. Jacqueline Wilson's double act is a great example of that, yeah, too. It's with Ruby and Garnet. They definitely play on that trope. I think one is, or there is the one is good and one is evil. Which we see. But then which you get into doppelganger sort of territory anyway. And then the third characterization is two halves of a whole. So these twins are one and the same. They can feel each other's pain, read each other's minds, or they don't feel complete without the other. They only exist as one being split into two. Again, Fred and George fit into this kind of as well, Fred and George Weasley, as well as being interchangeable. I'd always said that I had a problem with Fred's girlfriend marrying George at the end of Harry Potter, because they are not one and the same person. Like, they're just not, but whatever. Can you be surprised with problematic J.K. Rowling? Anyway. But also I think that you can say that the Vignay sisters are a bit like this, two halves of a whole. I think you definitely see that Desiree misses not having Stella there. Like, she's not completely one, a whole person, or yeah, she's missing something. Yeah.
It's like something's
and
missing.
Then
yeah,
finally, and of course, if you, I couldn't not talk about this because it's a good school favourite in Britain, which is Blood Brothers. It's a play that you get to study at school in some schools, normally at GCSE, although I did it in Year 9 SATs.
Oh, advanced level.
No, I think they were recycling through. I think they were going to do something else, and they were just like, well, we're going to prep you guys for what GCSE looks like, because they didn't have any other content for the rest of the year.
Oh, do you know what? SATs are the... Why are just SATs? Anyway, I don't think they exist anymore, do they? I don't really know.
I don't know why we had... I don't know. I don't see why you have SATs if you then have to do G... Ugh, whatever.
Been a long old time since we've been at school. Anyway.
Blood Brothers opened in Act 1 with the following passage. So did you hear the story of the Johnston twins, as like each other as two new pins, of one womb born on the selfsame day, how one was kept and one given away? Now, I can't take credit for this, this next piece of analysis, but Dr. Aidan on YouTube, go look him up.
Check him out.
talks about this even more. Go check it out. Well, it's because it's been ages since I've done Blood Brothers, and it's just so fantastic. And when I first thought of it going into this episode, I was like, oh my god, yes, because there's a superstition around it. But actually, because they break up and then come together again, and then there's superstition in There was a superstition that if twins are separated at birth and then brought back together and then told that they were twins, that then both would die at the same time, like in the next few moments. So crazy superstition, and that informs a lot of the plot of the play. But also it's a look at class and classism in Britain, which is a thing. Don't let the government tell you otherwise, as opposed to what was dropped today about white privilege, but I'm not going into that right now.
I was going to bring that up with you earlier, then I was like, no, I'm not going to, because I think it will open a conversation and we'll be talking about it for like 6 hours.
So there's Nadine White, is the independent, she's the first reporter for like like inclusivity or something. I can't remember her title. But she dropped like the findings of the report last night on Twitter, and it just makes me so angry because these same MPs voted against giving kids food.
Honestly, I saw it on the BBC and I was like, what is this?
They want to start culture wars to divide the country as opposed to just doing the right thing.
That's exactly what they want.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they want. And like, you know, the laptops that didn't go to the school children because they didn't want to take on, anyway. I digress. Back to twins. Dr. Aidan, the simile, so Dr. Aidan talks about this opening passage, and the simile each other like each other as two new pins suggests that the Johnston twins are identical in every way, every single way, and the similarity is reinforced by self-same in that passage. And then when they say how one was kept and one was given away, it invites us to think about the social environment affecting one's choices, which I think is like a really nice segue into the vanishing half, because it is a lot of the social environment, it is a lot of the racial prejudice, it is a lot of both intrapersonal racial prejudice and also racism faced in society itself that informs a lot of the decisions that Stella makes and in her feeling like she belongs. But I wanted to check with you two things.
Yeah.
Whether you how do you feel about Pat as a twin? How do you feel about twin representation in books? And then do you think we can explore some of those factors, like what's highlighted in Willie Russell's Blood Brothers and how they relate to this book?
I mean, I think twins are obviously like quite a good like literary tool because they allow you to explore like two sides of like personality sometimes, like when there's like differences, if they're like two completely different people, for example, that's like quite an easy way to like explore that. For example, I do think though sometimes like it just makes me cringe a bit, like the stereotypes of some twins. I'm just like, no, it's not like that. Like even not even just in books, but like when people find out I'm a twin, sometimes like the stupid questions I get sometimes are really like, they're quite funny. Like, they'll be like, oh, do you know what your brother's thinking? I'm like, no, I actually have no idea what goes through my brother's head. I'm not going to lie to you. Or like, oh, are you identical? And I'm like, no, he's a boy. Yeah, but are you identical? No, he was born as a man and I was born as a woman. Like, that's what I meant by that, actually. So, no, because that means we don't have the same DNA.
You are dizygotic. Such as twins, fraternal. Monozygotic is identical. Ah, which one was it? It's something sesigotic, the thing I was talking about earlier. So it's 50 to 100% genetic DNA, where the DNA is a bit, is more closely matched, but it's not quite monozygotic. So there's like a thing in between.
Oh, okay. I mean, to be honest, like, I think, yeah, I don't know. Like, obviously I know about twins because, like, I'm like, oh, what does it mean? But, like, I think most non-identical twins literally are just siblings. Like, I don't think I'm any more similar to my twin than I am my other brother. Like, we're all just, like, the same, but we were just in the womb together. I always make jokes to him. I'm like, oh, yeah, but we had the nine-month party in the womb together.
We were just, like, hanging. It's so insane, like, some of the stuff that Hank Green was talking about. He divided it up into six different things, but then he said there's this vanishing twin syndrome, which I think is great because we're talking about the vanishing half, in which one twin dies spontaneously and it is absorbed by the other. And I feel like Stella sort of like dies spontaneously and Desiree sort of absorbs those feelings.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Absorbs that lonely. I was like, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think the twins in this novel, like, there's definitely a lot of like when, so for example, they witness their dad getting like beaten up and
murdered.
They react No, he doesn't get murdered at that point, does he? He gets murdered in the hospital.
Hi, it's Ellie again in editing. So the word we were looking for in this specific place was lynch. The intent was to kill him. They lynched him. And when they didn't do the job properly or found that they hadn't finished him off, they went back to the hospital and killed him. So yes, he was lynched by a mob for and was accused of something he didn't do. Back to the episode.
Yeah, but that what they witness, anyway, they witness something absolutely horrendous and they react really differently to it, don't they? And that's, I find that quite interesting. And I remember, I can't remember which twin it was, but one of the twins was like, oh, I used to have nightmares and they didn't, and I didn't understand why.
Was it Stella that had?
Really interesting, because they saw the exact same. Yeah, they saw the exact same, like, traumatic thing, but then, obviously, that's like, they don't need to be twins for that to be a thing, because people do react to trauma differently. But I just think, because they're twins, it's like, oh, here's one way of reacting to it, and here's another way of reacting to it, you know?
Should we talk about the setting of this novel? Because I think you said for you, you found it really interesting. So we went to the Waterstones event with Britt Bennett. It was Britt Bennett and I forgot who interviewed her, but he was fantastic. And she talked about the setting and that it was really influenced by, I guess, the 2014 era Donald Trump times. And you said you really enjoyed that part of the conversation.
Yeah, because she basically said that she was inspired to write about how the past was like spun and twisted into a story for like a present narrative, and like how how things are spun, particularly like Trump, he'd be like, well, I can't think of an example, but he just like used to spin stuff to like suit his narrative and stuff, and like how she wanted to tell the story, and then that's how it ended up being set.
It was
at
like
the time that it was.
It was like she was saying that he evoked nostalgia for some people in that time, of this time where America was grey, and obviously they're in that being grey,
yeah,
that other people had to suffer at the hands.
Great
for some, not for others. And that would, if we're going back to a time where it was great for some and not for others, and I think you could, because everything that's happened in America is still so recent. The civil rights movement was only in the 60s. So
yeah. Do you know that always, like, when I actually sit down and think about that, actually blows my mind a little bit how recent that is.
Yeah, it was insane. And he really did, like, he evoked some sort of feeling in people. But also she said she ultimately wanted to tell a story of a fractured family, which is something that we had spoken about before. And so it sort of came together quite nicely that way.
Yeah. And what's so brilliant about that is, like, the storyline of the book is also fractured. And, like, that's just great. Like, if you're going to study this for your A-level exam, you could tear that apart. You could write paragraphs and paragraphs.
It's just so...
If this doesn't make it onto the syllabus, I will be so shocked. I'll be so shocked. If this is not on a syllabus, I will actually walk down to whatever the exam boards are and be like, are you doing? Put this on the syllabus.
Put it on there now.
Listen to my podcast about it and I'll tell you
it's
why.
Just so fantastic. And she's so well thought out. She talks about how it feels to be alienated from your own body, right, and place. And this, when you were talking about the senseless beating of her father, murder of him eventually, because I think that's what basically sets them in their tracks for the rest of the novel. They don't run away. They drop out of school to help their mother.
It's not a choice. Forced to, basically, because their mum needs help, and it's actually really sad. That bit really got me, actually. I know the whole book's got lots of sad bits, but that bit I felt really sorry for, was it Desiree or Stella that
Stella
wanted
to go to school.
Stella. Stella really wanted to go to school, didn't she? And then, really got me. Yeah. In the feels.
They grow up in the town called Mallard. Mallard is in Louisiana. It is a town that's filled with very, very, very light-skinned Black people, almost to the point of passing, and they pride themselves on that. So there's lots of like intra-racial things that happen in this book, because one of the twins does return to Mallard and she goes back with a daughter that is dark-skinned, and that causes a lot of issues within the town, because it's like a big no-no, quite frankly, for them. So that was quite an interesting.
And she's like the only dark-skinned girl in that class, isn't she?
That comes when with its own issues, doesn't it? But the vehicle is that they... I think the shocking thing for them, and I don't know... Obviously, there were instances of before with white people when it came, white people in their town, I should say. There has been stuff, I think.
First and foremost, it's them witnessing the lynching of their father.
And the twins are kind of defined by that moment, aren't they? Because then they're known as those twins that dad was murdered, in the town. Like,
and I think they
how they're known,
understand more is, that it doesn't matter what kind of Black you are still marked as Black. And I think that informs a lot of what... Well, when they run away to New Orleans, and it just adds to... that anyway, like when they're cleaning, one of them is sexually assaulted, raped, I don't remember, both.
I think both, actually. When they're kids and they're cleaning with their mum, so when they dropped out of school, that's when that happens. And then I think that's one of the like other catalysts for them to run away, and then they run away together and start a new life, and it's all fine to begin with. Like, I think obviously their living situation is not great and like it's difficult, but then Stella basically goes to this job where you basically have to be white, and because she passes, doesn't she, like someone thinks she's white, so she goes for this job, and like to begin with they both sort of like encourage it, and they're like, oh well, if you can get this job, like go for it, like it's a good job kind of thing. And then she sort of like gets sort of obsessed with the fact that she was she passed as white, and then the guy that she works for like ends up like dating her and marrying her.
She doesn't
look back, basically. She's like, I'm white now, that's it. And she cuts all of her ties to her family, to her sister, like, which honestly just pisses me off so much that she cuts the ties of her sister. Like, obviously she does it because she's like, oh, I need to live this new life. And it's so complex and so like. And when you actually think about it, you're like, oh God, that's so sad. And I feel sorry for her that she is in a society where she feels like she has to do that in order to survive and live a better life. Obviously, that is so shit. But then the fact that she just leaves her sister just really winds me up. Like, you just don't do that.
I think with that, it's interesting because... Britt said in the chat that it was interesting that people had complicated feelings towards Stella, and that they didn't outrightly hate her because they knew that it was actually more complex than that. So there was...
Well, it's not just her being a dick, is it? It's like society has such a massive part to play in all of her actions that you're like, you feel quite sorry for her. I had the tip of my tongue.
When lots of bad things happen to you, I think she felt sort of alienated from being, not alienated, but like outside of being Black. I think she just associated it with bad. So I was reading The Blacker the Berry, and the more
that was
it's a book about a dark-skinned lady that described as being like indigo in skin color. So it's interesting how her own community treats her. And so because she faces a lot of barriers in being treated differently by her own community because she's considered too dark, that she almost rejects them because of it. It's like, because they reject her, I reject you back kind of thing, and having that sort of relationship with your community. Yeah. And like, I mean, we talk about Stella and colorism, but there's the way she behaves, and then you look at like Jude, who is dark skinned, who comes to this community, but she doesn't have the same outlook in that way, where she rejects her community because, or the people around her because, or yeah, society because she's been treated, you know, it's just how people deal with stuff.
She does run away from Mallard though. So she does run away from Mallard. So she kind of rejects Mallard a little bit, but like, I think that's, to me, that was more of her like spreading her wings and like going onto bigger and better things. Like she ends up going to medical school and stuff like that. Like she wants so much for herself that like she's like needs to go elsewhere to get that.
I was thinking more on an identity point of view. Yeah.
No, yeah, I know, but that's what I'm saying. I think the reason she leaves Mallard is not the same.
Yeah, I'm thinking more.
It's not like
the identity of. I mean, she could never stay in Mallard because Mallard never accepted her. But I mean, as in how they see their identity in being black, and what I mean, Jude is not in a position where she can be like, I'm not black, because her skin speaks for her, whereas like Stella decides that she's going to just reject that.
Hi, it's Ellie in editing again. I don't think I got my point across quite clearly in this section, so I'm going to try and do it now. I think what I was trying to say was that Stella and Jude's identity, or how they understand blackness, is very much formed by how their experiences in the world, within their community, and also within society at a broader scale. And so because of those experiences, it informs their understanding what blackness is to them, and they deal with that in the ways that they deal with it in the book. Back to the episode.
Do you think she's embarrassed almost? Because I kind of got the impression when I was reading it that she kind of got almost embarrassed that she'd done it, but once she'd done it, that was it. She made her decision. I think there's a passage in the book actually where it's like, well, once I made the decision, like that was that. Like I couldn't really go back and be like, can you accept me back into the community?
She's already done it. Because she disappeared. So could you imagine just being like, hey, I'm back, and then having to explain it to your husband, like, by the way, I'm actually black.
I forgot to tell you.
It would just slip my mind. So we're talking about identity in this way. So class is also like a massive point in this book. And Britt Bennett talks about how Stella performs whiteness and wealth. And her learned perception, her learned performance of what whiteness is based off her, would have been based off her interactions around white people from Louisiana and how they saw blackness, and how that was given and give, like the give and take and receiving of that. And so her husband is actually sort of embarrassed by her.
She has to like pretend to be rich as well as white. Like, oh God. So it must be exhausting for the poor woman. Like, just be yourself.
She has this like outright rejection of black people, especially when the walkers move into town, because
she starts off by being like really overtly racist towards them and like just really horrible, because she's just terrified, isn't she, that they're going to see her
she's also performing what she sees as whiteness because of what she's learned. Whereas like, and this is so fascinating, and this also happens in The Dark of the Berry, The Black of the Berry. In The Black of the Berry, there's this idea that, oh, because I've come from a small town in the middle of fuck knows where, America, and if I go to the coast, things will be different because it's more urban, it's more like the racism won't exist, but it still does exist, it just exists in different ways. And
Because Brett Bennett talked about
it. It does exist. You go to the coast. So in The Black of the Berry, she goes to the coast. She goes to the California, and it's like, oh, but she's rejected by black people there. And then she goes to Harlem, and it's somewhat the same but different. And yeah, Brett definitely talks about this here. And so the regions, how people deal with race in those regions. And her husband is outright, like, because she's so outright, like, absolutely not racist, he's embarrassed by it, because that's not how you deal with things when you're white and wealthy in California. It's not how we behave. You can have these thoughts, but not like this.
Yeah, he's a bit like, oh, it's a bit, yeah, he's a bit like, oh, I'm a bit shocked by that. Oh god, yeah. But I actually on that point of like racism being like different in different places, I think that's quite, like, the guy who hosted the session, the Waterstone sessions, Britt Bennett, said that for British readers reading the book, that's quite an interesting thing for them to think about, because obviously I think sometimes a certain type of person in the UK might be like, well, the UK is not racist, but it is. It's just not in the same way that it might be in the US. There are different things that happen here that are still racist. Simply, it's actually not that hard to understand, but because it's not the same as the US, it's like, and it's really important that people recognize what is racism and what is racism in different parts of society, and not just what you've seen overtly, like, for example, the murder of George Floyd. It's not just that, it's all the little things as well, and it's really important that we recognize that in the UK. I know a lot of our audience is from the UK, so I don't know what you guys think about that comparison.
There was an interesting article that came out. I think we talked about it when we tried to record this the first time, and I'm not going to talk about it verbatim because it was a while ago, but there was this, it was a Daily Fail article, Daily Mail, but the Daily Fail. And they had done two articles, maybe like a week or two apart, in which the second article,
it was about the best places to live, wasn't it? And then the first one was something like the best places to live, and it listed a load of places. And then the other one was like, oh, this town is too,
places that white people can't live in because it's been aggressively taken over by Muslims or something stupid like that. Racist.
Something really ridiculous. But 2 weeks earlier, they'd said that it was the best place to live.
Like that. Exactly. And it set up this whole conversation on Twitter, because people of colour were like, I don't go to the countryside because I already know what it is when I go, because these are all, like, what was it someone spoke about going to a pub and seeing what the reaction was?
So someone had written like a tweet that went viral saying, I'm looking to move to wherever, and the first thing I do is go to the local pub to see how people react to me. Which is just, I mean, you can't then sit there and be like, well, racism doesn't exist here. You just can't. You actually just can't. Like, you have to listen to people and you have to understand. Anyway, it's not, we're preaching to the choir here probably, because I imagine if you've read The Vanishing Half, you probably feel the same. And it's important to have the conversations. I think, like, especially with older generations, I strongly disagree with the whole narrative of like, oh, well, you know, they're really old and it was different, like, but like certain older generations where I've been like, no, actually, I'm gonna tell you why that's not right, and I'm gonna explain it to you, and I don't really care whether it goes in or not, I'm still gonna say it, because a little bit of it might go in, and then they might think twice the next time they want to say something, or they might question some of their thoughts in the future, and I don't think it's ever too late to learn. And I think you should have a conversation with everyone, not just people who, you know, are going to get,
and just because we live in London doesn't mean that the racism here doesn't exist. It does. Just because we're in a city and we're more metropolitan, a bit more tolerant, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So I'm just putting that out there as well. But it's not just the countryside. Sorry, that's not really, like, that was just an example, but Anyway, well, that was quite the digression. not really.
Well, kind of, but not really.
So we talk about the Walkers moving in and Stella becoming deeply uncomfortable. But because, one, she doesn't want to be found out, but two, you also see that she is, there's a part of them moving there that makes her realise what she's missing, because she's missing, she's not her whole self, she can't truly be herself, like you said before, because she's not being true to herself, she's rejected that part of herself.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the introduction of Loretta Walker into this section of the book, and how that plays out in how, I guess, Stella sort of not has a reckoning, but how she sort of like then views race again and stuff like that.
And I almost feel like she sort of like pines after the friendship
with Loretta.
It's because Ellie's friend is called Loretta.
Liz gonna listen.
I was like, Lorena's, I know it's not quite right.
You've been talking about me. With love, Lorena, with love.
Yeah,
with love, girl.
Right, babe. I've just been learning about what's it, jelly.
Like Mang. No, Mang in what's it? Ginny and Georgia, but jelly.
Ginny and Georgia.
Hi.
Hilarious. Anyway, I forgot what I was
going to say. We were talking about Loretta pining after
something friendship. About Loretta. She wants to, Stella really wants to be friends with her in the end, and they end up being quite good friends, and I find that.
Until they're not.
Very interesting.
And so why did, what happened? They end up moving, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was, so they moved basically the Walkers, and I forget Loretta's husband's name, but he's an actor and it's all, you know, smiles and laughter that he, and yeah, we love him until he moves into the area. And then when he moves into the area, which is a predominantly white area, it's an issue because we were talking about this before, weren't we, when we were talking about redlining and stuff like that. There's situations whereby the community are always having like meetings about this black family being in the town, and eventually they drive them out. But again, Britt Bennett says in the talk that, you know, the Walkers didn't necessarily see themselves as people that were, you know, trying to champion or drive change. They just wanted to live in a,
they weren't trying to be activists.
They just wanted to live there. They just wanted to live in the suburbs.
Yeah,
it's
their best life, man.
It was a nice area where the kids could learn, where they could go to good schools, and it isn't exactly what anyone ever wants for their own children, for their own lives. And the introduction of them turns basic. I think Stella is a lot of the driving force behind them really not having a great time, is because she's so vocal against them. She's quite sort of two-faced, isn't it? It's like, just get them out of the town.
I think she stands up. Yeah, she stands up in a meeting. I remember reading that.
Then she goes over there and has like tea and coffee and meets her mates.
Yeah. Oh, this is why you want to hate Stella, because you're like, what are you doing? But then also,
it's not that simple. Because you do feel sorry for her in the fact that she pines for.
So sorry for her. Like, so sorry for her. Like,
she could end this though. She could end it. She could end it as easily as she started it. She could end it, you know?
You tell her,
I mean, it's not really as easy as that, I know.
Yeah, but she almost has an opportunity, because she does actually go back to Mallard. She does have an opportunity to make amends, and she doesn't. She leaves it.
Yeah.
So it's very, there has been a few comments and conversations about, I think you said this to me, I think you read it somewhere, that people are looking at Stella as a character and her identity and what she rejects, and then Reese,
because they play opposite. They play opposite each other. They play opposite each other. I think purposefully, to see how someone comes to embrace themselves and how the other one rejects it and pushes it away. And Reese's character yeah. is so it's just, oh, you love Reese from the jump.
I love Reese. It's such a great character, like such a great characterization, I meant to say.
Yeah, he's a trans man. He comes into himself. He meets Jude in where is it? California? Is it California as well? I can't remember where they meet. New York.
Isn't he?
They meet at college when Jude is at college. I think that's probably the easiest thing to say.
Oh yeah. And then they go. Then the bar thing comes later.
How they meet, and they fall in love, and they fall in love with each other's souls, each other's like. Who?
It's so great. It's just when that storyline got introduced, I was like, this book was good already, but now it's like, yes, we love this. We love to see this. And then at the end, when they're like. Because obviously it's a secret that he is trans because of the time, because it's in the 60s. And then at the end, Jude's like, Desiree's like, oh, are you going to have kids? Like, I want you to give me some grandchildren. And they just sort of look at each other and they're like, oh. And then you're just like, oh, but they're so in love. And like, I really want it to work out for them. And if they want kids, I want them to have kids, you know? And it's just like, oh.
It's great, and yeah, they're both great examples of how they perform identity, and that's like a huge, as you already know, it's a huge theme in this book. And it's not just like Stella and Reese performing identity, there's also in like Barry's character how he performs identity, and how Stella's daughter, whose name is, I want to say Hayley, but it's definitely not Hayley.
No, it's
Kennedy. Oh, see something.
Kennedy.
Kennedy, yeah. How they perform identity. They're different.
And there's the whole comparison with like the theatre and the stage. Oh, it's just so good. There's so much to analyse. There's so much to like look about at.
When that happens because of vote. It's so.
But also on Reese, I think it's actually a really interesting insight into like what it meant to be trans in that time. And like, he obviously has his operation that like is actually like, it actually stressed me out a bit because I was like, oh my God, I hope it's safe. Cause like when they were saving up for it and stuff, obviously it's all like under the table and stuff.
It's just people always have to perform their identity, and who we say we are and who we are requires repeated performance, I guess. And like Kennedy's true identity is hidden from herself because she doesn't know who she is, and a lot of that is tied to Stella. And I was going to say to you, do you think Stella is sort of complicit in one, Kennedy being entitled, because she is entitled. We see that in her character. She very much is spoiled and entitled, but a lot of that comes from, I guess, pushing boundaries with her mum because she knows her mum is hiding something from her. And a lot of that would help Kennedy form ideas about her own identity if Stella was only honest with her. She knows that she's not being honest with her, and she acts recklessly because of it.
It's like that thing about kids know, don't they? Yeah. I think Stella can never truly be herself in the life that she's built for herself because she's lying to everyone all the time. So then she's lying to her kid all the time, and that's obviously going to have an impact on a new kid. And also, she's brought up in such a privileged, wealthy position. She doesn't quite know, like...
That's what
she's just like, oh, I can get whatever the hell I want whenever I want it. What am I going to do with that?
That's why she can never really distinguish between when she's an actor on stage and when she's an actor and who she is in real life.
She's acting all the time, but in a different way. Like, she's performing in terms of like, she's trying to be this really interesting person who's like rejecting the fact that she's like really rich, and she's like, oh, but I'm gonna go and be a struggling actor.
But even when she becomes successful, she can't switch. Whereas like Barry, when he comes off the stage, he is Barry the drag queen on stage, and then when he comes off stage, he can distinguish between the two characters.
There's a really
Kennedy never does.
There was a really nice bit in the book. Yeah, there was a really nice bit in the book about, I think Jude's talking to Barry about like the drag scene and like why they really like it and what attracts them to it and stuff. I can't remember what it said, but I remember that being quite a like nice little passage. And just like his
Jude is really
just,
like
really
brought
simple.
Into this community, like, right? Yeah. There's a, you know, we
yeah, they just hug her into
Jude,
it.
Jude has
like, come
like
on,
found Jude has Desiree, she has Early, which we will get to. Early is like her, I guess, acts like her stepdad, but she also has this found family in when she goes to college as well that
yeah,
embrace her, which
really
is something
nice.
She never got from her community back in Mallard. I wanted to touch on. Oh, go on.
I was just going to say on that, like, it's really nice as well that it's like they're all unapologetically themselves in that community, which is just like quite a nice contrast to Stella.
I just wanted to touch on violence again one last time, because we talk about how the girls witness the violence that happens to their father. And in the Waterstones event, Britt says that she wrote about violence as in a way as seeing it removed. And in exploring the idea of seeing it removed from yourself, so like I guess that outer body experience. And I thought it was really interesting because she talks about the ways in which Black people experience violence, and we already sort of touched on George Floyd, and we talk about that in Such a Fun Age, the importance of documentation, right? For Emira in Such a Fun Age, she doesn't want to do anything with that documentation, but it. Yeah. It also, the ideas of progress in that, and then the backlash as well that comes with those sorts of things. And like we know that, but like it's not also just like the physical part of it, it's also like the emotional and mental violence. So we see in Such a Fun Age, and when Britt was talking about Black people experience violence, it made me think of the Childish Gambino lyric in This Is America, because like the whole thing is littered with the whole video, the music, the video, the composition, everything signifies something, everything has a connotation, everything, there's so much in it, it's just rich with symbolism, but in particular I want to focus on the idea of, so like, you know, there's like entertainment as a distraction because there's so much chaos going on, but you're busy watching these kids do viral TikTok dances or whatever it is that they're doing in the video, but there's lots of double meaning. So there's a set of lyrics where he was like, I'm gonna get it, watch me move, this is a celly, that is a tool. And so we know, like, and then they sort of show the tool, like the kids on the cell phone, they're recording Childish Gambino and these kids doing a dance in that space, as well as everything else. Like, you know, our phone is something that we can record viral TikTok videos on. It's also a place where you can record viral videos of violence against, you know, Black people or other groups of in society. And it is a tool in that way, and it's just so, I was like, oh god, that's so profound. But also like, yeah, no, and then like is, also, you know? There was this, oh, I can't remember who did it, but there was like, this is a celly, also like, you know, as well as being a cell phone, being a tool to document brutality or like a viral TikTok video or whatever, it could also mean like a cell block, because the whole thing, the whole space that they record in, they're doing that video, looks like a disused jail, as opposed, like everything, when I say everything had a connotation and symbol and double meaning in that video, I mean everything. And they were saying that cells could be, this could be interpreted, the warehouse could be interpreted as a jail, because oftentimes it's a tool to keep Black people in a cycle of incarceration, which is just so like deep and profound. And yeah,
do you know what? You could probably write just as much about that as you could about this.
That should
book.
Be on the
maybe that should be on the syllabus
as well. Yeah. I just like
they should study stuff.
They're probably
like that,
doing
though,
like
don't you think?
If you anyway, do like media studies at A level and stuff like that. I could imagine this video is something that was doing it.
Probably at university.
Oh
as well.
Yeah.
You could definitely like
for sure. sociology, psychology, all of that. Yeah.
Even linguistics, like I did a analysis on like the gender pay gap and how it was reported and stuff, and like looked at, anyway, I won't get into that, but like you could
so
like,
many things,
so many places you could study this,
but that's what I particularly liked about when Britt Bennett was talking about violence in this way and seeing it removed and how black people experience violence, both like physically, mentally, emotionally. And then it made me think of this in particular, because I remembered that lyric as she was saying it, and how our tool is something that you can document and experience violence through is just like, and because we had that conversation, I just thought I'd like bring it up now. Cause yeah, it is a way in which experience what black violence look like, as well as other types of other violence as well, but we only have to look at the George Floyd video,
and particularly like I was gonna say the fact that that's literally on video, and then the guy
it's interesting.
No, it is, and I think it's a really important thing to like sit down and think about sometimes. I think sometimes we forget, like, literally everything is, like, the evidence is there, you know? And it's, like, and sometimes we forget that, like, it's way too easy to access stuff sometimes in terms of, like, a trauma point of view. Like, the internet's a bit scary for people if there's, like, particular triggers and stuff. Like, that's why I think, like, trigger warnings and stuff are an interesting conversation, because it's, like, is the trigger warning in itself a trigger? But then you kind of need the trigger warnings, because if someone's going to be, you can't just have content that might be triggering. Yeah. So that's just, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I got lost in thought there.
I think one more point that I think we sort of touched on earlier and is like a good part of the book, and I think something that we want to talk about is Early and Desiree's relationship, and how it's like really unconventional in terms of like what society deems conventional relationship. You know, you get married, you live together, blah, 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 and they have like this relationship where he's like traveling and then he comes back and goes again, and it's like just perfect for both of them and what they need. And I think Britt Bennett touched upon that a little bit, saying that like it's in a lot of narrative and a lot of story, there is the conventional, they fall in love and they get married. And like, actually, like we do need more stories that are love stories that aren't following the conventions of society, because they are happy. They have what they need from each other. And it's a really nice, relationship storyline in the book. And I think especially like I really like reading romantic novels. Like I'm quite into the genre, and like I'm a bit of a hopes romantic, and I really really like that this novel has like romance that is not just boy meets girl, fall in love. Like obviously that is a nice narrative to have sometimes and like whatever, but I think this book does a really important thing. You still have that narrative, but these are different love stories. And,
it's nice. Yeah, they're not bound by convention in an era where you are bound by convention, and it was refreshing because she comes from she experiences violence as well, but at the hands of a ex-husband who she runs away from, and there's this little subplot throughout the book where he's sort of like seeking her out. Trying to find her.
Oh yeah, sorry, I should have given the context of how
earlier the guy that she met when she was like nine, like younger, and then they reconnect in this way, in this beautiful way.
Yeah, because earlier it's like a manhunter. Yeah,
he's like a bounty hunter.
I don't really know what he does. He finds people. Yeah, that's what I meant. That's the word I was looking for. I was like, what's the word? He basically looks for criminals and stuff, and then he gets this job that's looking for this guy's wife, and it turns out, and then he sees her, and he's like, and then he sees the bruises, and then he just gives a false trail to the husband, because he's like, gonna do the right thing.
He also does try to find Stella in the book. without success, because like Kat said earlier, she is it the mother dies? Something happens in which she comes back to Mallard. Yeah.
It's when her mum dies, I think. Jude finds her, obviously, and then doesn't she say something? I don't know. Basically, Jude finds Stella. She ends up waitressing at a party, doesn't she? Or something. And then she makes friends with Kennedy.
Always say there's going to be spoilers, guys. Sorry. But Kennedy and Jude do connect, and Kennedy does find out the truth via Jude sometime in the future. But she never brings it up to her mother. She decides that's not something she's going to discuss with her mum. I can't remember for what reason now. It's been a while since I read it.
But anyway, it's just basically, summarise, guys, there is so much that you could analyze in this book, and it's just got so many great storylines. It touches on so many things in so many ways without even being that complicated. Like, the story's not that complicated. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many complicated elements to it but when you're reading the story, you're like, I know what's going on. I don't need to concentrate that hard.
If you like this, if you want to read more along these lines, I think Passing by Nella Larsen, she said, was like one of the books that's definitely influenced it. I would definitely recommend The Black of the Berry by Wallace Thurman. Like I said before, it's set in 1920s Harlem, so that was like in the Harlem Renaissance, if you want to read in and around that. And this book, like The Black of the Berry, was like considered really controversial because it looked at interracial racism. It explores it, and it's a nice counterpoint to looking at that in regards to Jude as well. And I think there's this on page 105, it talks about why lighter skinned black people discriminate against dark skinned black people in that time, in 1920s Harlem, in such a way. And if you ever watch if you've ever watched Blackish, or if you've ever watched Black AF on Netflix, or Blackish, now it's on Disney Plus because, you know, ABC.
Disney Plus has got significantly better recently.
Kenya Barris always says, you know, everything is rooted in slavery, and it truly is. Like, when we talk about American race terms, everything is rooted in slavery. Because of slavery.
Read Homegoing. But you should also read Homegoing, because that book is exceptional. I'm not gonna say anymore, just read it. Just read it, guys. And also, if you haven't read The Vanishing Half, what are you doing? Get off your sofa and go and buy it.
What are you reading now?
I am reading The Road Trip still by Beth O'Leary, because it was in paperback, so I didn't take it away with me, hardback, and it's hench, and you know how I feel about hardbacks, so I didn't take it away with me. So I stopped reading it, so I'm still reading it, and I'm also reading The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead, because we're doing it for book club.
Oh, crap, I need to...
So two very different books.
What are you reading? The Nickel Boys, because, yeah, we're doing it for a book club. I'm reading Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro for another book club. And we've got that on Monday, and it's just I think we've got it on Monday. I just need to confirm whether I'm going to that or not. I've totally forgotten. It's interesting. I've actually found it hard slog to get through. To be fair, I'm sort of going between audiobook and book itself, because I've gotten to this point where I'm finding the first 100 pages of any book hard to read, and so I've been doing it on audiobook to get past that.
Yeah.
But also, it's like, it's the themes and the ideas are interesting, but it was really slow to get to the point where I am at now, and I've got less than 100 pages to go. So I don't really know how it's going to resolve it, because they've introduced this so late. It's I'll let you know how I feel when I finish it. But
It's quite hyped, isn't it?
So yeah, I mean, there's definitely lots of interesting stuff in that that you can definitely, that you can discuss, because it's sort of like a sci-fi slash dystopian. Something's happened, basically, in this world that I think is set in the future, where kids need artificial friends. They call them AFs. They don't ever tell you why.
Okay.
That's what's happened. And it follows this particular AF called Clara and this family and this deep adult thing.
I like it's more sci-fi,
I would say.
It's right. Well, yeah, I'm gonna borrow it from you.
It's super slow, I would say. It took a while, but yeah, you can definitely borrow it. Yeah, you it's can definitely shame. Borrow it. I'd like to get your opinion on what you thought. What do you think?
You can buy the road trip.
I can't believe you haven't finished that. Someone on my Goodreads gave it a 5, and I was going to check in with you and see how you were doing.
I haven't finished it. I went home for a week. I didn't take it with me because I am enjoying it, but not as much. I like it, but I like it in terms of like it's one of those books that's just really comforting to read, and you're just like, oh.
Are you comparing it to the Fletcher? Do you find that when you read her books now that you might compare to the Fletcher?
She's definitely got a formula. Like, she's definitely got a formula.
Why fix it?
If it's not broken, why fix it?
Yeah,
that's the right thing to say, isn't it? Don't know, my brain's gone. But I am really enjoying it so far. I think it'll depend what happens. I tell you what. Hold on.
Hold the line, caller.
Hold on.
Oh, God. Oh, it is really big.
I just had to take my microphone off to go and fetch. It's Hinge. Yeah, I told you. I'm on page 200 and something, and it's like 400 pages. So I'm only just over halfway. So the verdict is still out.
Right. Well, guys, I guess the next book is, I think we put on Instagram. Again, follow us there so you know what's up next. Will be by Taylor Jenkins Reid. It'll be Daisy Jones and the Six. Again, another favourite of ours.
We will have read Malibu Rising by then as well.
Probably not. We've got so much to read. We haven't actually decided our next books, though, after that. So it could very much be a thing.
We could just become a Taylor Jenkins Reid
fan club.
I think we already are a Brit Bennett fan club, though.
With a Jenny Han one, too.
From this episode.
We love everyone.
We just love everyone.
And I guess, I was going to say to you, because Love Island starts next week, and you said you had complicated feelings about it starting. But I feel like it might become a Love Island podcast from next.
Yeah, maybe we should save Love Island.
We're going into it now because I think there's so much to say, but I reckon because it starts next week, we'll become a Love Island podcast as well, as because there'll be lots of it on when we're recording, I'm sure.
Potentially slightly ashamed to say that I watch it, but we all need an escape.
good chat, guys. We'll link the resources that we used to help us inform this discussion today. Yeah. And we'll see you next time for Daisy Jones and the Six.
Yeah. Okay, love you, bye.
And that's the app. If you like the episode, please leave us a lovely review, subscribe and share with your friends, and we'll love you forever. Follow us on socials at We Are Bookish Pod. Thanks for listening.